Thank you.
Make me earn it. Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here. I want to do a few things this evening, and I'll start from the end. I'll try to leave time. It's not a promise. It's a commitment, though, for questions and answers. I want to talk about what's going on in the region and how that affects all of us, Israel from up close, but all of us. But before I do, there are two subjects that I want to speak about that are sort of current, immediate, and don't fit well into sort of the general narrative that I'll be giving you. The first is the recent recognition by the Trump administration of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. First the president, and then recently, the last few days, Vice President Pence in Israel reaffirmed all of that. And there are a few things about it. I know you follow it, so I'd like to just focus on a few points of it that, what can I say, you don't really get from your media here in the United States. And don't get me started. So first of all, I think it's very important for us to understand that President Trump did not make Jerusalem the capital of Israel. See, that was kind of taken care of about 3,000 years ago by someone with a little higher authority. And about 7 decades ago, the modern state of Israel reaffirmed that by making Jerusalem its capital. So in effect, what the Trump administration has done, and I don't belittle this in any way, but what the Trump administration has done is simply bring American policy in line with reality. And that's not trivial, because let's face it, for nearly 70 years, American policy has been out of line with reality. And that's important to Israel. It's also important to the United States. From an Israeli point of view, you know, if your greatest friend and ally is building its policy on something that is not reality, that's a little concerning. Right? I mean, there's no big secret here. If what you're doing is based on unreality, chances are it's not going to work out really well down the road. And by the same token, it's important for the United States for the exact same reason. American policy is now in line with reality. And it recognizes reality. And I repeat that because it sounds really simple, and it's not. Because you know what? Leaders, like most of us, would rather live in unreality. It's sometimes so much easier. Facts are kind of tough. Speaking that truth has had a couple of interesting ramifications. One, let me let you in on a secret. There's one superpower in the world. It's called the United States of America. America leads. You don't have to like it, but it's a fact. Okay? As soon as the United States recognized Jerusalem as the capital and said, we're moving the embassy, and Vice President Pence a few days ago said, by the end of 2019, but already when President Trump did it, the Czech Republic said, we're doing it too. Guatemala jumped in and said, we're in it as well. And the reports are that some 35 other countries are now negotiating with Israel's foreign ministry to move their embassies to Jerusalem. Okay. So isn't it interesting how when America states the truth, a whole bunch of other countries fall into line? Okay. The truth also draws out other truths, and sometimes truths in the sense of what people really think and what they really believe. Because the Palestinian leadership, Mahmoud Abbas, who goes by his terrorist nickname Abu Mazen, also came out with some statements because that prodded by the American declaration. He said, you know, the Jews really don't belong here. Israel is a European colonial venture, and they shipped the Jews here to Palestine, and then those Jews, liars that they are, and by the way, I'm quoting pretty much verbatim, pretty much, not absolutely, liars that they are, then fabricated this story of a Jewish connection to Palestine. You know, we wrote the Bible about 50 years ago, right? But this is their narrative. Now, we knew it. Abu Mazen, in case you didn't know, wrote his PhD on the denial of the Holocaust. So this isn't something he started like 2 weeks ago. But here now, he states openly what they're actually thinking and what they believe. And that is that the Jewish people has no connection to the land of Israel. Now, I find that kind of insulting as a Jew, but I think as Christians you might find it a little problematic as well. Just a little. Before I go to that, there's something else. There were all sorts of warnings before President Trump made the declaration that all sorts of things were going to happen. And I just want to reassure you, because when we got out of the car on the way into the church, I checked, the sky still has not fallen. Okay. And again, most countries, even Arab countries, simply said, okay, you know, here it is. It's a fact. Shortly after the declaration, UN Ambassador Nikki Haley made a speech, and a few other administration people followed suit, and said that this declaration does not predetermine the outcome of negotiations. Because, in fact, in that declaration, which recognized Jerusalem as the capital, it doesn't mark the boundaries of the city. In other words, it doesn't say Israel should have this much and not this much, because it's left open to negotiations to determine where the lines are. But here I have to tell you that that statement isn't quite correct. It's correct in Western terms, the way we understand things. But it's not quite correct. Because by declaring as he did, President Trump did determine something that is not fully accepted by Israel's neighbors and enemies. And that is that at the end of the process, Israel will still be there. And we kind of take that for granted, but not everybody out there does. And if you agree and believe that Israel's share in Jerusalem is something larger than zero, then it didn't determine the outcome of the negotiations. But if, on the other hand, you believe that Israel's share in Jerusalem is zero, and Israel's right to exist is zero, then declaring it is a determination of the outcome. And we don't think that way. But we need to understand that there are those out there who do, to this very day, and are committed to the destruction of Israel. And that it's not about where the lines are going to be, but it's where Israel is not going to be as far as they're concerned. It's a difficult thing to say and think about, and I have to tell you, it's not easy to contemplate on a daily basis being surrounded by people who spend all of their waking hours thinking about how to destroy you. Think they'd get a life and get a job. But. Okay, so that's the Jerusalem issue. A second issue I want to talk a little bit about is something called BDS. BDS is an abbreviation for a movement that's known as Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. Something that started a little over a decade ago and has gained a certain amount of traction, not a huge amount. But it's out there and it's of a concern to us. And toward the end of my talk today, I'll link it to what's going on today. But there are two levels or two phases to BDS. One is the statement that Israel should be boycotted, divested from in terms of investment, and sanctioned. And behind it is another phase, which is the argument for why that should happen. In other words, why should we boycott Israel? Because Israel commits genocide, because Israel is apartheid, because Israel is discriminatory, colonialist, imperialist, expansionist, et cetera, which is also a lie. Now, we have a tendency, and it's a natural tendency, and I say this as somebody who's involved very much in advocating and fighting for Israel, we have a tendency to oppose what's up front rather than what's behind. And the up front part, which is also a lie, is kind of less really the issue than what's behind it. Let me give you an idea of what I mean. In a kind of strange, maybe even perverse kind of way, I support BDS. What do I mean by that? I think that people who really hate Israel should boycott Israel. And they should boycott everything Israeli. Hand in their cell phones. Hand in their computers. If you have a computer with an Intel chip in it, came from us. And if that's got a little sticker on it that says Intel inside, what it really means is Israel inside. Stop using Google and everything associated with it. Stop using Microsoft and everything associated with it. I think you get the picture. Okay? Now, these people don't do that. They talk tough. Right? They talk the talk. They don't walk the walk. I was just at the CUFI Leadership Conference in San Antonio, and they had some students. There's a branch of CUFI on campus, college students. And some of the students were talking about what's going on in their campuses, and one young lady from the University of Michigan told about how their student government passed a resolution to boycott Israel and to boycott companies that do business with Israel. And one of the ones explicitly mentioned was Boeing. And I thought about it, and the next day I spoke, and I said the following. I said, you know, it's kind of interesting. When was the last time you bought a 737? Anyway, yeah. I mean, might like to, but... So that's kind of nonsense. But do you think any of them would dare say, I will not get on a Boeing airplane? I'd rather walk. Right? Can you see that? Get to the airport, get on the... Oh, no, it's a Boeing. Right, sure. I'll go a step further, because not just Boeing. Any airplane built in the United States of America has Israeli Elbit electronic systems in it. There is not an aircraft built in the United States that does not have Israeli components. So don't fly. I'm okay with that. Boycott us. See how far you get. Okay. But of course they don't do that because they're liars. I'll be even more brutal. Israel, in a number of its universities today, and I don't want to predict because these things are so unpredictable, but I can give you a snapshot, is on the verge of conquering many forms of cancer. As a matter of fact, I'm writing my doctorate at Bar-Ilan University. In our biology departments, they have isolated the enzyme that fuels cancer cells. In other words, the nourishment that cancer cells need is driven by an enzyme, and they have figured out how to turn it off. Okay? And that's now going into human testing. In other words, it's gone through one phase, it's going to... Will it work? I have no idea. But it's very promising. You hate Israel? Don't use it. Okay? Right. Sure. Okay? The real danger, because you know they're gonna. The real danger is the corrosive effect of the backstory to it. Because how many times can you hear in the background Israel genocide, Israel apartheid, Israel oppression, genocide, apartheid, oppression, before you start thinking, hey, you know what, this is a really terrible place. And I just want to give you one idea of how much of a lie it is, although I'm sure you know this. Genocide. In the past 70 years, the Palestinian population has increased by 1,000%. This is the most inefficient genocide in the history of humanity. Okay? But again, if you keep repeating it, that has an effect, and I'm going to end this segment here. I'm going to come back to this BDS issue a little bit further on. And how it affects all of us. With that, I want to take a look at the region. I'll do it relatively briefly because it's not just a lecture, it's not even a course, it's a full degree. So I'm going to really zoom in a bit. Israel is located in a region that essentially doesn't exist anymore. Once upon a time, there was a place called the Middle East. It isn't there. And when I say that it isn't there, I don't mean it's not on the maps. I mean that it's not there as a geopolitical, geostrategic entity. It's gone. By the way, along with it, gone is the Arab world. And the Arab world and the Middle East are basically the same. That doesn't mean there are no Arabs. It means that there is no body that speaks as a single voice of an Arab world. Both the Arab world and the Middle East were created about 100 years ago. during World War I by the British and the French in a series of agreements called the Sykes-Picot Agreements. And if you look at a map of the Middle East, you can see a lot of straight lines of borders. You know what that means? It means they sat somewhere else with rulers, and they drew lines. Okay, note that Europe has no straight line borders. Because for 400 years, they fought each other, and they've decided, we'll stop here, we'll stop there, usually rivers, mountains, forests, whatever. That's the reality on the ground. By doing it with rulers, they essentially ignored everything that was happening in the Middle East. Geography, topography, resources, peoples, a merry mess. 100 years later, it fell apart. And here I have to say that while we can blame them for starting the mess, we also have to blame the people on the ground for continuing the mess. You know, just because you're dealt a bad hand doesn't mean you have to play it badly. And they played it badly, and here we are. Before I go on, I also want to make clear a definition. I said Arab world. When I say the word Arab, what do I mean? An Arab is a native speaker of Arabic. In other words, it's an ethnic cultural definition, very often misused and misunderstood in the United States. Arab does not mean Muslim. Now, there are Arabs who are Muslims. There are Muslims who are Arabs. But not every Arab is a Muslim, and not every Muslim is an Arab. Okay? Significantly, the country with the largest Muslim population in the world is Indonesia, which is not an Arab country. Prominent other Muslim countries, and this is not a comprehensive list, include Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran, Turkey. These are not Arab countries. They are Muslim countries. There are a bunch of others. I'll leave it at that. And I'm just going to repeat, Iran and Turkey are not Arab. They are not part of the Middle East. They are outsiders. Okay? If I had been here 20 years ago talking about the Middle East as a political entity, I'd be referring essentially to four countries that are the power players of the region. Egypt, Syria, Iraq, and Libya. Please note, I did not say Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is not a power, although it's undergoing a transition now. We'll see. Still too early to tell. But up until now, Saudi Arabia is the only country in the world that's named after a family. The Saudi Arabia, right? It's a family business. You should do so well. But basically, they pump oil out of the ground, they sell it, they waste the money, and they pump more oil out of the ground. When the Saudis have had a problem, they've bought the solution. They are financiers. They've bought American, they've bought European, they've bought Arab. They bought it. They've never solved their own problems. And again, the new leadership, the new generation, is trying to change that. I really wish them the best of luck. I'm not being cynical, but we'll see. Here I'm going to tell you now, I don't do prophecy. I'm a disciple of two great political philosophers, Winston Churchill and Yogi Berra. And both of them said it's best to prophesy about things that have already happened. Okay? So forward, we'll leave. So again, those four countries I mentioned, Egypt, Syria, Iraq, and Libya. Syria, Iraq, and Libya no longer exist. They're not there. Now, yeah, they're on the map, and they have leaders, and they have representatives in the UN who vote against Israel. But if a country really is a body, a political body that controls its territory, controls its borders, Syria, Iraq, and Libya don't. And I'll tell you from a strategic point of view, from a military point of view, what that means is there's no return address. Right? I mean, they do something, you want to turn and say, you did it. I'm holding you accountable. How can I hold a country accountable if it's not in control of its own territory? Now, Syria is the worst, but the others aren't very much better. What's left is chaos. And let me add a few points to those three that I mentioned. Lebanon doesn't exist. There are two armies in Lebanon. The second most powerful army in Lebanon is the Lebanese army. That's not a country. The most powerful army in Lebanon is Hezbollah. You can't have a country if the most powerful army in your country is a terrorist organization. Yemen doesn't exist. Sudan doesn't exist. What's left? A few emirates along the coast of the Persian Gulf. Jordan, which is hanging on by the skin of its teeth. Now, granted, it's been doing that for about 60 years, but still not a power player. Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco, that's the Arab world. Okay, so that force that used to be, and it was not friendly to Israel, so I don't say this with great nostalgia, but that force that used to be is gone. A few words on how that happened in sequence and a critical part of it, and then I'm going to bring us up to date on what it means to us. The initial step that began the unraveling of the Middle East was a decision by the United States of America nearly 20 years ago to withdraw from the region. And please note I said nearly 20 years ago. In other words, this is something that goes back multiple administrations. But just as I said before about the region, I can say as well about administrations. Just because you were handed a bad hand doesn't mean you have to play it as a bad hand. Okay. But under the Bush Jr. administration, the decision was made to begin to withdraw from the Middle East. There are a whole bunch of reasons. The primary one is that Middle Eastern oil is no longer important to the United States. And here I have to tell you, I deal in many fields. Energy is not one of them. In other words, I read stuff, but it's not my field of expertise. So I take it at face value when I'm told, and I'm told this by experts, America does no longer needs Middle Eastern oil. Okay, good, it doesn't. But here I've got a problem, because I am a strategist, and I do teach strategy, and I consult in strategy, and I kind of understand strategy, or at least that's what they tell me, and I never argue with them when they say I do. The Middle East has been a critical strategic imperial region for about 4,000 years. Okay, and by the way, you have to understand, we have a different view of history in Israel and the United States. What you call history in America, we call the late modern period. Right? We deal in millennia, centuries are rounding errors. Okay? So 4,000 years, 4,200 years, let's not get hung up on a couple of centuries. Oil has been important for about 100 years. So presumably something's been going on for 3,900 years before oil came onto the scene. Okay? And this is an area that has been conquered by empires that include local ones, eastern ones, Western ones. Apparently everybody wants it. Now, okay, we can say there's a spiritual reason for it. It's God's center. Great. But there's something else going on there. The Middle East is a land bridge between continents, Africa, Asia, and Europe. And it's also a land bridge between oceans. Okay, and Israel's a very good example of it. We have ports on the Mediterranean, Haifa and Ashdod, that lead out to the Atlantic. And we have a port in Eilat that goes out through the Red Sea, the Indian Ocean, to the Pacific. Egypt is similar. The region in general is in that location where you can go to the Atlantic in one direction, the Pacific in the other. Panama is like that, but Panama doesn't have the land centrality that the Middle East has. In other words, if you control this region, you control land and sea traffic throughout the entire world. And the 4,000-year history of that is important in our understanding because what that means is that it transcends technology, right? 4,000 years ago, technology was a little bit different. 3,000 years ago was a little bit different. 2,000 years ago was a little bit different. 1,000 years ago and 500 years ago a little bit different. So you can't say, well, we're in a new time now. It doesn't matter anymore. Because everybody says that. They've been saying that every year for 4,000 years. So presumably whatever it was is still there. Washington apparently missed that class. And America pulled out militarily, it pulled out diplomatically. And I'm talking about in terms of the use of its power. I'll give you an interesting example. In June, I don't know how closely you follow the news of Israel, but in June, an American aircraft carrier visited the port of Haifa for the first time in 17 years. Okay, American aircraft carriers used to show up once every 6 months or so. 17 years. Why? Because for the past 17 years, there has not been an American aircraft carrier stationed in the Mediterranean. It's an absence of power. And all sorts of mischief has been made in that absence. Okay, because what happens? America pulls out. Those Arab countries that I mentioned before went into collapse. Nature abhors a vacuum. And when there's a vacuum, others step in. So on the one hand, one level, terrorist organizations stepped in. But on a much more important level, three other powers decided to make their move on the Middle East. I call them imperial wannabes. Russia, Turkey, and Iran. Now, why do I say imperial wannabes? Because we know they want to become empires. They want the Middle East because they didn't miss that class. And they understand its importance. And last but not least, each one, for their own reason and with their own strategy, has their eye on the one adversary they need to contend with in order to gain their power. And again, that's the United States of America. Israel, and I'll come back to this in a little bit, Israel's danger to them is as America's ally. Because everybody knows, except the ones in Washington who've missed the class, that Israel is America's unsinkable aircraft carrier in the Mediterranean. I'll give you an analogy, and it's one that I feel safe to give in New Jersey. It's not so safe in places like Boston and L.A. America is to global politics as the Yankees are to baseball. Imagine saying that in Boston. What do I mean by that? They win often. 27 World Series, right? I love saying that in Chicago. Okay. They win often. They lose sometimes. But regardless, they're always the team to beat. And everybody hates them. That's America. Get used to it. And if you're from New York, you say, good, hate me. What do I care? So when countries like that make their move, they have one eye on America because America's the adversary. Whether it's ideological or not just adds to it. In other words, Iran hates America for a bunch of reasons. Russia just sees America as the obstacle to their political power. Now, how do I know this? And here it's kind of interesting. I know it because they tell me. And here I have to say I like Mr. Putin and Mr. Erdogan and Khamenei and the terrorist organizations like Hamas and Hezbollah. I like them. I like honest murderers. Because they make my job as a strategic analyst so much easier. I just listen to them. And here I'll tell you, this is an important rule. You can write this down. It's paraphrasing Elie Wiesel. It's always better to believe your enemy's threats than your friend's promises. Right? So let me give you some examples. You see what I mean. I'll back up a step. In strategic analysis, trying to analyze an adversary and project and predict, it ultimately boils down to two categories. And I'm really oversimplifying, but it really boils down to two categories. One is called capabilities, and the other is called intentions. And it's almost always easier to assess capabilities than intentions. Right? What do they have? What do they know? What can they do? Capabilities. I'll give you an example from another area. North Korea. Right? We know what they've got, more or less. We know what they've got. What's his intention, that lunatic? Who knows? He doesn't know what his intentions are. How do you develop a strategy under those circumstances? This is really the quandary of American policy there. Okay? He's in the Olympics. He's not. Okay? In the Middle East and with the Russians, it's much, much easier. Let me start with the easiest one, Hamas, the Islamic terrorist organization that controls Gaza and is trying to control the West Bank and is deeply in cahoots with Iran and Hezbollah. The Hamas Charter, which they call the Covenant of Allah. By the way, you can look this up. You can Google it. It's perfectly safe. First line, you don't have to read very much. One line, the opening line of the charter says, Israel will exist until Islam obliterates it. What's their plan? Right? It's really not that complicated. When Iran says Israel is a cancer and it needs to be wiped off the map, gee, what are their intentions? By the way, when they say death to America, what do you think they really mean? Do you know that Iran celebrates Death to America Day every November? You celebrate Thanksgiving? Same thing, right? We don't understand them. We don't understand a society that lives by the idea of declaring death to other people. And here, I have to say this as an aside. We can't understand them. We can't. We come from a philosophy, a theology that says love and you shall choose life. And when they say we love death more than you love life, we don't understand it. We can't. By the way, I say give them what they want, but that's a whole different story. I'm a friendly guy. All right. What do we do when we don't comprehend something? We ignore it. Right? Because there's a point. How far can you hit your head against it? I don't understand it. Ignore it. And that's in part what we've been doing. When Putin says, I want to rebuild the Russian Empire, what he wants to do is rebuild the Russian Empire. And with that, he's moving into the Middle East for the reasons I mentioned before. I won't go into all of Russian strategy. I don't have the time for it. But what he's doing in Syria primarily is to allow him to have naval bases through which he can get out to the Atlantic, because the battle for America and Europe is fought in the Atlantic. That's why the Western organization called the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Turkey is on the Mediterranean. It wants to get to the Persian Gulf. And Erdogan wants to rebuild the Ottoman Empire. How do we know? Because he says so. He wants to be the sultan. He wants to be the caliph. The Ottoman Empire was the last Islamic empire. He wants to build a new one. That's the real Islamic State, by the way, not those ISIS guys. And he's not quite ready yet, although the collapse of Syria today is enticing him to move. And if you've been following the news, he invaded Syria about 3-4 days ago. We'll see where that goes. The real threat, though, is Iran. It's a real threat to Israel, and it's a real threat to the United States, and I want to focus on that because ultimately Iran and its agents are the ones that we are all going to be facing. Israel first, because for us it's a one fair zone. They're right, as was mentioned, my backyard. I should mention, I still serve, I'm an active reserve officer. I serve in Northern Command of the Israel military. Northern Command is responsible for the Lebanese and Syrian borders. So it's never boring. When Khomeini came to power in 1979, he made clear a number of things that were, again, ignored by the West. One is that he said, we're going to rebuild the Persian Empire. And if you don't know what that means, open the Book of Esther and read it. 127 provinces, India to Ethiopia, an empire that was a player for over 1,000 years and with aspirations of global conquest. They never made it, but you know what? Take another shot, 1,500 years later. Second, they said, he said, we are at war with our primary enemy, our number one enemy, the great Satan of America. And also, by the way, the little Satan, that's us. It's important to understand that when Khomeini spoke of the great Satan and the little Satan, he was not speaking in geographical terms. He was speaking in theological terms. America isn't the great Satan because of its size. It's the great Satan because of its evil. And its influence, its evil influence. You know what America's evil influence is? Democracy, freedom, openness, antithetical to the thinking of the Ayatollahs of Iran, as we just saw recently in the demonstrations. And Israel, because it's there, is certainly an immediate threat to them, to their world conquest. Khomeini knew, and the Ayatollahs knew, and they know to this day, they must have the Middle East in order to carry out that plan. Because again, they didn't miss that class. There was an interesting article a few years ago by Garry Kasparov, the great chess master. And he was talking about, first of all, how Putin is a great chess player. He mentioned the Americans are still learning to play checkers. He didn't actually say it, but you could read it between the lines. But Putin is a very good chess player. But let's not forget that the Persians invented chess. They forgot more about chess than Putin knows. I'll let you teach you something useless trivia, but it's always great stuff. Checkmate. Checkmate is the English version of the Persian shahmat. The king is dead. The shah is dead. It's Persian. So he understood. Khomeini understood and his followers understood they need to move into the Middle East. He had a problem. It's a problem that they didn't quite get here in America because they hadn't worked out all the details. The Persians are not Middle Eastern. They're Persian. And the Arabs and the Persians have been enemies for, I don't know, 1,000 years plus. So what do? He can't play the Arab card because he isn't one. He plays the Shiite Muslim card. And with that, he makes his move. To make a very, very long story very, very short, he manages to establish himself in Lebanon. Lebanon had collapsed in a civil war a few years earlier. And in Lebanon, he creates a Shiite terrorist organization called the Party of God, Hezbollah. Hezbollah is the most dangerous terrorist organization in the world. Not Al-Qaeda, not ISIS. They're dangerous, they're deadly, don't get me wrong. But Hezbollah is the most dangerous out there. And incidentally, they have infiltrated the United States of America in very large numbers through the Mexican border. Within a few years, in the 1980s, Hezbollah brings one of its two great inventions to the world. It's called suicide terrorism. Suicide bombings start with Hezbollah, not Al-Qaeda. And acting under the orders of Iran, in America, the press says that Hezbollah is a proxy of Iran. Hezbollah is not a proxy. It's an agent. And the difference is significant and important. A proxy does something that you benefit from. An agent does what you tell them to do. Hezbollah takes its orders from the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps Quds Force. There's a hierarchy, and Iran is at the top of the pyramid. Within a few short years, in the 1980s, Hezbollah starts suicide terrorism. Significantly, of their first three major attacks, two of the targets are American. Think about that. Three major attacks till the mid-1980s in Lebanon, two of the targets are American. They blow up the American embassy in Beirut, twice, by the way, and the American Marine barracks in Beirut, killing 241 Marines. So help me out here. If blowing up an embassy twice and a Marine barracks and killing 241 Marines are not acts of war, can somebody in this room please tell me what is an act of war? Iran and America have been at war since 1979, and one side doesn't recognize it. And that side is not Iran. America gave them $150 billion a couple of years ago. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And with that, Iran has continued killing American troops in Iraq, Afghanistan, supporting the Taliban to this day. That's Iran. Hezbollah in the 1990s brought us something new, again from Iran. It's what we call today hybrid warfare. Once upon a time, there were terrorists and there were guerrilla fighters. In the 1990s, they fused them. Today, this is not just Israel, but America as well, doesn't face terrorist organizations. It faces terrorist armies. Whether they're good or not so good, they're armies. We saw it with ISIS. Armies. Trained as armies, equipped as armies. Whether they're well-trained or not, Hezbollah is well-trained and well-equipped and well-organized, all by Iran. Now, Syria is collapsing, in part because of, ultimately, the defeat of ISIS. That's a good thing. But the defeat of ISIS means there's another vacuum being created, a second vacuum after the first one of the collapse of the Syrian state. And Iran is taking advantage of it. Iran is moving to the Mediterranean. They already have a port, a naval base in the Mediterranean, as do the Russians, and for the exact same reason. And before I focus on what's happening in Israel, I want to explain to you why that matters to you. If you listen to your talking heads, they'll tell you that Iran is interested in regional power, Middle East hegemonic power, and the reason it wants a port on the Mediterranean is for that reason. I will tell you nonsense. Because the Middle East, as a region, has no interest in the Mediterranean. The Mediterranean has no value to Middle Eastern power. And I'll prove it to you scripturally. This is a test. I know you people know your scripture. In the last chapter of Deuteronomy, God takes Moses up to Mount Nebo and he shows him the land. Right? And it describes, he says, he looks out and he sees the area of Jericho, and I'm now paraphrasing, he sees the Negev, the south, he sees the land of Judah, and it says he shows him to the sea. So here's my question. In the text, how is that sea named in that last chapter of Deuteronomy? What is the name of the sea as written in the text of that last chapter? No. Not the Great Sea. In Hebrew it says Ad Hayam Ha'acharon, which means until the last sea. Why the last sea? Because if your center is to the east, whether it's Baghdad or Damascus or Tehran of today, the Mediterranean is beyond your region. Right? It may have some value for coastal trade up and down the coast, but as a sea, it has no strategic value. It's out there, the last sea. When does it become the Mediterranean, Mediterranean land? With the Greeks, the Romans, Carthage. In other words, when the center of power moves westward, the Mediterranean now becomes an important strategic sea. But for the Middle East, that has no value. So what do they need the Mediterranean for? Not for the Middle East. Did I mention death to America? They want to be able to get out to the Atlantic. They didn't report this very well here. The Iranians have already said that they plan to send naval ships to patrol the Caribbean. That wasn't part of the Middle East last time I checked. They're building ballistic missiles that can carry a nuclear weapon to the United States of America. That's not part of the Middle East. And by the way, if you're thinking to yourselves, they wouldn't dare. Let me tell you something. One of the subjects I have studied over the years is called strategic surprise. Pearl Harbor, the German invasion of Russia, the Yom Kippur War of 1973. One of the things that all of those and others have in common is that the side that was surprised said they wouldn't dare. The Japanese, they wouldn't dare attack Pearl Harbor. We've got a fleet there. When I hear they wouldn't dare, I say, where's my helmet? If they're building it, it's because they would dare. Would it be a mistake for them? Certainly. But what would it cost America along the way? Right? The Japanese made a mistake at Pearl Harbor, and it came home to roost a few years later in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But how many Americans died in the process? Paying for the Japanese mistake? That's a concern. So if you haven't figured this out, let me help you. Connect some dots. Death to America, naval bases in the Mediterranean, a ballistic missile that can reach the United States carrying a nuclear weapon, and a nuclear weapons program. If it's still not clear, see me after class. I'll explain it to you in more detail. They also are moving toward the Israeli border. And we know they've been trying for a number of years to establish themselves on the border of Israel with Syria. We've managed up until now to prevent that from happening. I told you before I don't do prophecy. Here I'll make an exception. We will fail. We will fail. They will get to the border. Now, when I say we will fail, what I mean is we will not be able to prevent it without a military confrontation. We don't want that. Our definition of success is to keep them away without a war. If we have to go to war, then we haven't really accomplished much. But we will fail in that. With all of that, we face the most immediate and dangerous threat to us from Hezbollah in Lebanon. We fought a war with them in 2006. And during that war, during the summer, and I spent 5 weeks on active duty in the north during that summer, during that war, 4,000 rockets fell on northern Israel during that summer of that five-week campaign. 2 million people's lives were utterly paralyzed and disrupted by those rockets. We didn't have a lot of casualties, in large part because our civil defense system is very effective. Today, Hezbollah has some 250,000 rockets, over 10 times the number they started with in 2006. They're longer range, heavier payload, more accurate, and they have the ability to launch many dozens of them simultaneously at a single target. That means that a system called the Iron Dome, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but the Iron Dome is an incredibly sophisticated, semi-miraculous piece of technology. I'm a low-tech guy. When I say semi-miraculous technology, in one sentence, it's pretty amazing stuff, that intercepts rockets. It won't work because there'll be simply too many rockets for it to intercept. In sports, it's called flooding the zone. Their plan is to fire 2,000 rockets a day into Israel. I'm going to say again, over in 2006, 5 weeks, 4,000 rockets, 2,000 a day is their plan in the next round. And for us, that's a critical difference. What it means is that we're moving into a new era. And we're moving out of an era that I call luxury war. Up until now, since the 1970s, since after the Yom Kippur War of 1973, Israel's been fighting what I call luxury war. Now, I need to explain that because it's kind of a weird term. For the people on the ground, the people doing the fighting, there's no luxury. But for the decision makers, there is. The commodity that makes a difference between crisis and luxury in decision making is time. And by the way, it's true for all of us, not just for national leaders. If you have time, you have luxury. You have an issue, whatever it is, and it could be a very serious issue. If you have time, you can think about it, you can get advice, you can gather resources, you can play it out, you can do some trial and error. You may not succeed, but your decision-making is under luxurious circumstances. Take that exact same issue and have to deal with it right this second, and you have a crisis. Okay? When a couple of hundred rockets are being fired and you have a system that can intercept most of them, you could say, you know what, tomorrow's another day. Maybe they'll stop. Maybe we'll poke them a couple of times, they'll get the message. When 2,000 rockets a day are falling on your country, you don't have that luxury. And what that means is that Israel will no longer be able to put into practice what we have preached and practiced to ourselves for decades. And that is to be the most ethical army in the world. There's a British colonel who used to command the British forces in Afghanistan named Richard Kemp who made a statement a few years ago in 2009 that no army in the history of warfare has protected enemy civilians like the Israeli military. And I don't mind quoting him. He's also a friend of mine. He lost a lot of friends when he said that, but that's a whole different story. I want to give you two examples of what that means, just to sort of concretize it. The Israeli army is the only army in the world that has a unit of soldiers who speak the enemy's language fluently and whose mission is to call enemy civilians on their cell phones and tell them, in effect, listen, we're going to be attacking your neighborhood tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. You shouldn't be home. Okay, now, think about what that means in terms of resources. I mean, you'd imagine that an army would have something better to do with fluent speakers of the enemy's language. How much intelligence work goes into getting those phone numbers and identifying who and where and that sort of thing. And most important, what does it mean to a military operation to tell your enemy a day in advance what you're planning to do? Now, granted, we do all sorts of things to make it a little less obvious, but still, sometimes they guess right as a result of that, and that means the operation has to be called off. Because, you know, if you're ready to jump off and you see the other side is sitting ready waiting for you, you say, you know what, maybe not today. What that means is that whatever that objective was that presumably needed to be taken because you were planning an operation is not going to be taken today. In luxury war, you say, all right, I'll do it tomorrow. I'll do it the next day. I'll do it the day after. In not luxury war, you can't do that. The Israeli Air Force is the only air force in the world that has a rule of engagement that states that a pilot or weapons officer may not release a guided weapon unless or until he or she has an alternative target in an open field, so that if civilians show up in the target area while the weapon is in flight, it can be diverted into the open field and wasted. By the way, if there are civilians in the target area before the launch, there's simply no permission to launch. Now, aside from the fact that very expensive munitions get wasted that way, what it means is, again, that a target that presumably needed to be destroyed because you just fired a very expensive missile at it doesn't get hit. When does it get hit? Maybe later, maybe tomorrow, maybe in a couple of days, three, five, maybe not at all. Luxury war. When 2,000 rockets a day are falling on your civilians, you can't fight that kind of war. The next round will have to be very fast. We cannot fight a 5-week war of 2,000 rockets a day. And fast in military terms means violent. All war is violent, but like anything else, there are levels. It's also no secret that our enemies, and Hezbollah certainly at the head of this pack, store their weapons in private homes. They launch them from private homes, from schoolyards, from hospitals. Because for them, it's a win-win. If they succeed in launching them, they've succeeded in launching them. And if we take them out and destroy a private home, we're war criminals. By the way, we're not. We're not. It's not against international law to hit military targets in civilian areas. But CNN won't tell you that. By the way, I have to be clear on this. When I say CNN, I don't mean the station. I mean the whole fast food news business. Where CNN stands for certainly not news. Okay? But I mean all of them. All of them. I won't go into listing. Whichever one you're watching, that's one of them. Okay? Even the most pro-Israel administration, and I'm not giving grades here, I'm not saying this one is or isn't, but even the most pro-Israel American administration will be hard-pressed to support Israel against an onslaught of press and public opinion. As I mentioned before about Jerusalem, it's true in other things as well, America leads. And America's behavior toward Israel, especially in crisis, will affect the behavior of other countries as well. America is critical. Israel has two friends in the world, two countries that consistently support Israel, the United States of America and Micronesia. I don't know why. And we love them. They're wonderful people. But, you know, if you have two friends in the world, and one is the world's superpower, and the other one has the word micro in its name, it doesn't leave you lots of options. American support is critical. I told you I would tie the BDS story into it. Here's where it ties in. Because that undercurrent of Israel being brutal and murderous and killing and that sort of thing sets, again, something of a foundation for those news stories and public opinion that will be turning against Israel. And it's there. We know it's there. Israel has had a policy throughout its history. It's one that I strongly support, vocally support, and that is we don't want anybody to do our fighting for us. American troops don't fight for Israel. What we need is support, equipment, diplomatic support, and frankly, with all due respect, get out of our way. And we'll take care of it. It has very often not been the case. This coming round, because of the new period that we're moving into, it will become that much more critical. Having said that, that's where people like yourselves come in. Because if you support Israel, the time is approaching where, as a friend of mine, Ari Morgenstern from Kufi, says, this is what's going to separate the men from the boys. If we allow the other side to control that field, it will make it much more difficult for Israel to do what it needs to do. Now, I'm going to let you in on a little secret. You live in a democratic republic. And that means that the real power in this country is not in some oval room in Washington. The real power in this country is in rooms like this. Now, if you don't exercise power, you lose it. So first and foremost, if you don't vote, you lose your license to complain for 4 years. But even if you do vote, exercising once every 4 years doesn't do a lot of good. My wife Shoshana here, I keep trying to tell her, oh, well, exercise once every 4 years, go to the gym. Okay? Exercising your power means being active about it. Now, active here, I have to say, I don't work for Christians United for Israel, I work with them. I'm not an employee. I work with them in large part because I absolutely believe what I'm about to say. It is one of the most important pro-Israel organizations, not in the United States, in the world. And it's one very good way of doing it. But whether you do it that way or not, it's up to you. I will suggest that if you don't tell your leaders what you're thinking, you're not using your power. If they do something you don't like, tell them respectfully, hey, I don't like it. And it doesn't have to be long and involved. Today it's free because you can do it by email. Once you had it, you just have to buy a stamp, right? Just as important and maybe even more important, and we're less good at this, if they do something you do like, thank them. First of all, it's the right thing to do, right? Be courteous. Please, thank you, right? You know that. But there's another reason, too. Because if they're doing something you like, there's a very good chance that there's somebody out there who doesn't like it, who's telling them they didn't like it. It would be a good idea for them to hear from the other side that there are people who appreciated it. Learn about this stuff. It's an enormously complicated situation, but it boils down to a few very simple points. And there's information out there. You don't have to be fully eloquent. You have to know certain basic things. There's a clip by Dennis Prager, Prager University, about the Middle East. I'll boil it down very simply. I don't know if any of you have seen it. He says, the Middle East conflict is very easy to understand. It's not easy to solve. It's very easy to understand. One side wants the other side dead. Now you understand it. Okay? There really aren't that many things. When they say Israel's committing genocide, as I mentioned earlier, say, so how come there are so many more today than there were then? Israel's apartheid. Then how come there are Arab members of Knesset? How come there's an Arab justice in the Supreme Court? This isn't apartheid as I understand it, etc. So being active is critically important. And being prepared to be active and to speak about it, and this is something, and I'm a firm believer in this, with all due respect to media and social media and all of that, I'm an old-fashioned guy. You know how you convince people? Or by the water cooler at work, in the supermarket, talking about it. And that's really very effective. I want to conclude, I ask your permission, so, to teach you a little Torah, a little scripture. And I want to start by saying this. I will be the last person to tell you that prayer is not important. Prayer is very important. However, it isn't always the immediately indicated response. And that's what I want to teach you about. In the first five books of Scripture, the five books of Moses, the Torah, Moses appears in four of the five, right? He's not in Genesis, but from Exodus to the end, to Deuteronomy. And if you read it, and I see enough people nodding, you know the text. I can do this in Hebrew, right? No, I'll translate it to you. You get the impression very early on that God and Moses have a very good relationship. I kind of get the sense that they meet every morning over coffee. They talk about what happened yesterday, what they're going to do today, right? God tells him what he has in mind. Moses argues with him, right? By the way, having an argument is part of a good relationship. Absence of conflict is apathy. Absence of conflict means you don't care. How you resolve it is the measure of the relationship. And they argue. And God wins a bunch, and Moses wins a few, which is also kind of interesting, right? I mean, there are times when God says, all right, we'll do it your way. They show each other the greatest respect. And here again, so Moses respects God, we expect that. But God also respects Moses. You can see it in the nature of the discourse, especially in the arguments. From the very, very beginning, from what I call the job interview, the burning bush. Right? No? God says things, step into my office, take off your shoes. Right? I have a job for you. Moses said, I don't want it. He said, I didn't ask you. I'm not qualified. You're not qualified to say whether you're qualified. I don't know how to speak. That's why I gave you a brother. Go get them out of there. Right? But it's respectful. I mean, you would think, right? God is telling Moses, here, I've got this grand job for you, and he stopped. He doesn't get angry with him. He explains it. He works his way through. There's one spot in the Torah where God verbally backhand slaps Moses across the face. And I want to set it up for you. It's in Exodus. We have the Exodus, children of Israel leave Egypt. A week later, they're on the shores of the Red Sea. Along the way, Pharaoh wakes up one morning and says, what do we do? We let them go? That was a mistake. Let's go get them. And he loads up his chariots, and it's very interesting. The English translations are never perfect. Some are better than others. But it says, and some are worse than others, obviously, it says that he filled his chariots. Adjutants is the word that's used, or something like that. The Hebrew word is very interesting. The Hebrew word is shalishim, from the word shalosh, which means three. The Egyptian chariots typically had two men on them. Pharaoh puts a third man on every chariot to show the Israelites that he means business. And they look out from the shores of the sea, and here's the Egyptian army pounding down on them in the chariots. And they panic. A week ago we were slaves, and here they come. And they turn to Moses, and they say, "Hamibli en kvarim b'Mitzrayim," is because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us out here to die in the desert. There were cynics back then too. Now this isn't in the text, but I guarantee you that this is where Moses turns to God and says, "I told you I didn't want this job." Right? But what he actually said in the text is very powerful. He says to the Israelites, look upon the Egyptians. As you see them today, you will never see them again. You are about to see the glory or the awesomeness of God, depending on how you translate it. Adonai yilachem lachem va'atem tacharishun. God will fight for you and you will be silent. Wow. That's when God slaps him. That's when God slaps him. The English translations are invariably wrong. The one that I like most in its wrongness, I think it's King James. God says to Moses, "Wherefore criest thou unto me?" That's not what it says in Hebrew. In Hebrew it says, "Vayomer Adonai Moshe," God says to Moses, and listen to the Hebrew even if you don't understand it, because you can get a sense of it from the words. He says, "Ma titzak elai." Sounds rather harsh, doesn't it? Because it is. What it means is, what are you yelling at me for? Daber al bnei Yisrael v'Yisau, speak to the children of Israel that they should move. Don't talk to me, talk to them. And Rashi, the great medieval commentator, jumps all over it because this is so out of character. And he says, God is telling Moses, my people are in danger. Now is not the time for prayer. Now is the time for action. And I'll add parenthetically, you can pray when you get to the other side. Plenty of time for that. Right? Since I'm on a roll, let me add a couple of other points. You know that the Israelites from Egypt to the Jordan are led by a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire. Except here. Except here. Where are the pillar of cloud and fire at this point? They're behind them. Between them and the Egyptians, keeping them away apart all night. Do you understand the lesson? If you want God to cover your back, you better be moving. And last but not least, and maybe most important of all, and Cecil B. DeMille got this one wrong. The text tells us a few verses down that the children of Israel, Vayalchu b'toch hayam b'yabasha, they walked into the midst of the sea on dry land. The sea didn't split, and then they crossed. They walked into the midst of the sea, and then on dry land. You want a miracle? You don't stop at the edge and say, okay, open it up. You want a miracle? You have to get your feet wet. You have to march into the water. Then it's going to split. If you stand on the side and say, do it for me, you're going to be standing there a very, very long time. So in conclusion to you, our enemies, Israel's and America's, our enemies are on the march. Don't stop praying. But if all you're going to do is pray and you're going to wait on the side for the sea to split, it ain't happening. We have enemies marching against us. We're standing and marching against them as well. Standing aside and waiting for it to happen is not the way to get it done. So if you don't stand with Israel, march with Israel. Thank you for having me. God bless you.
Thank you, Elliot. Thank you. What a great night. I hope you learned something this evening.